This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
So his support for MK is also very significant, particularly around the KwaZulu-Natal area and among his Zulu co-ethnics, that sort of voting bloc.
That's David Monda, professor of political science at City University in New York, on former President Jacob Zuma's support for a party other than the ANC. Details coming up. Also, International Labor Day today has been observed in Cameroon, and mine experts warn that unexploded ordnance and landmines pose a threat in African nations. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. Former South African President Jacob Zuma, who was ousted amid corruption allegations, has thrown his considerable political weight behind a fresh rival to the ruling African National Congress. David Monda, professor of political science at City University in New York, tells me Zuma's Umkhonto weSizwe, or MK party, which takes its name from the ANC's former armed wing, adds more unpredictability to the coming elections in South Africa.
He is very influential. Let's not forget he's a national leader. He's an insider of the ANC. So during the years of apartheid, these were individuals who know the ANC inside out. So his support for MK is also very significant, particularly around the KwaZulu-Natal area and among his Zulu co-ethnics, that sort of voting bloc. He can deliver significant amount of votes away from the ANC.
I asked Professor Monda if Zuma is a real threat to the ANC.
So Zuma definitely is a veto player, but he is also a kingmaker in his own right. But I do not see him having significant a sway as to be able to deliver enough votes to the opposition, to MK in particular, for them to take power from the ANC. But he will significantly dent the ANC's capacity to be influential within KwaZulu-Natal. But also, let's not forget that that will also influence the Inkatha Freedom Party, because a lot of the votes which might have gone from KwaZulu-Natal to the ANC would either go to Zuma's MK or to the Inkatha Freedom Party. So it's a really fluid political situation in South Africa right now, and a worsening economy really doesn't help.
The 2024 elections in South Africa are taking place in the context of worldwide crisis. Monda says South Africa's support for Palestinians and its perceived alignment with Russia and China against the Western powers is damaging the country's relations with many countries.
But even if you think about their foreign policy, so the ANC and the leaders in ANC have really been very critical about the West in terms of their hypocrisy on foreign policy. So they talk about international norms and democracy, but they don't want to talk about it when their allies like Israel abuse human rights and go against international norms. They only want to do it against their enemies and rivals like North Korea or China, right? So ANC, South Africa, saying, you guys are completely hypocritical, and this really comes through in terms of their foreign policy. But the blowback with that is then the West will punish them in certain respects, because they're not towing the line on these foreign policy issues. And they are embarrassing major powers like the U.S. and the EU, particularly when you think about things in the Middle East right now, which is very unfortunate.
South Africans do not vote for a president. Instead, they elect the 400 members of the National Assembly who go on to vote for a new head of state within 30 days of the general election. And this year, polls indicate the ANC might lose control of the assembly and the presidency for the first time since democracy began 30 years ago. Incumbent President Cyril Ramaphosa, the leader of the main opposition from the Democratic Alliance, John Steenhuisen, Julius Malema, leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters, and MK's Zuma will all feature prominently in the campaigning this month. In related news, South African police are investigating if a former President Zuma's new political party, Forward, supporters' signature to register for the looming national elections. The MK party has been embroiled in legal cases over whether it and Zuma are eligible to contest the May 29th ballot. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said at the recent release of the State Department's annual country reports on human rights that standing up for freedom and human rights is simply the right thing to do. He said human rights and the rule of law are under increasing stress with governments locking up people who challenge those in power. As a candidate, President Joe Biden pledged to link foreign policy to the respect of human rights and democracy around the world. Shahidi Hamid, a Washington Post columnist, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi that has not been the case in North Africa and the Middle East.
Yeah, so it's true that the Biden administration prioritized democracy globally, certainly in its rhetoric, but that doesn't seem to apply to the Middle East. That's why we can speak of a Middle East exception. The Middle East stands apart in this respect, that there is still the same old reliance on Arab authoritarian regimes and not that much criticism or pushback against their human rights abuses. There are historical reasons for that, a sense that the U.S. needs Arab autocrats to preserve or promote its national security interests. I think that seeing how unstable the Middle East is now, we should question that premise. The reliance on Arab autocrats doesn't seem to ever lead to stability. Didn't during the Arab Spring. It's not now in light of the Gaza war and the regional repercussions. So I think that is a major gap in the Biden administration's approach, and it's worth questioning. If there is a serious commitment to global democracy promotion, it has to be global. There can't be a regional exception. Otherwise, it's not a real strategy. It's a strategy with caveats, and that undermines its effectiveness.
That brings me to another question. When Senegal managed to keep its democracy alive and had free and fair elections, the United States hailed the peaceful transition of power to the opposition. How do you explain this support compared to living with failed transitions in democracy in Tunisia and Egypt?
Oh, Senegal doesn't have real national security implications for the U.S., so American policymakers are going to be broadly supportive of democratization there. There isn't a major Islamist party in Senegal. Senegal's politics are quite different than the politics of the Middle East, which are much more contentious between secular parties and religiously inspired parties. So Senegal has the benefit of not being in the Middle East. Once you're located in the Middle East, then different rules apply, unfortunately. So Tunisia and Egypt are obviously two of the cases where I think many of us in the pro-democracy community, we wish that the U.S. would have been more proactive and would have made different decisions at key moments. And I think we have to look back at some of the mistakes that were made during the Arab Spring and ask ourselves, why didn't the Obama administration do more to keep those democracies alive? In the case of Egypt, in the case of Tunisia, obviously the decline there happened more recently under the Biden administration. And I think we have to ask, why didn't the Biden administration do more to try to keep Tunisia going on a positive path instead of accepting the coup that resulted in the rise of Kais Saied?
That was Sadi Hamid, a Washington Post columnist, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. International Labor Day has been observed today in Cameroon with hundreds of thousands of workers marching against abuses they say include illegal dismissals and failure to pay the $70 monthly minimum wage, even as the cost of living increases. Trade unions say tens of thousands of trained teachers, doctors, nurses have fled the country over the past year in protest of unemployment and hard working conditions with monthly salaries half the minimum. Moki Edwin Kinzaka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Depuis trop longtemps, le statut des travailleurs et travailleuses camerounais ne connaît plus de travail décent et de progrès.
This is the voice of Celestin Bama, Secretary General of the Confederation of Cameroon Workers Trade Union, or CSTC, addressing tens of thousands of workers at the May 20 Boulevard in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. Bama says the government of Cameroon has not done anything substantial within the past 30 years to improve the conditions of workers. 30 years ago, Cameroon imposed a 70% salary cut on government workers, Bama says, and adds that there is a growing need to increase wages as prices of basic commodities have witnessed a 40% spike. Cameroon trade unions say a 20% fuel price hike imposed by the government in February without a corresponding salary increase has also made living very difficult. During International Labor Day celebrations in Yaoundé and several other Cameroonian towns, including Boya and Bamenda in the English-speaking western regions, and Bafoussam, Douala, Garoua and Maroua, all French-speaking towns, trade union leaders said hardships, unemployment and low pay are causing trained professionals to flee. Anong Jacob is a member of the Cameroon Teachers Trade Union, or CATU. He says some private school owners pay teachers as little as $50 a month.
What do you expect from a teacher who earns 30,000 francs in a town like Yaoundé or Douala or Bamenda, Bafoussam? What quality of shoe or dress would you expect them to put and come to school? You see the poor teacher with twisted shirt, twisted shoes and all of that. Sometimes they don't have money to pay electricity bills. They suffer a lot of humiliation. I think the government should put some policies to see that proprietors and proprietors respect the minimum wage.
Cameroon's agreed minimum wage is $70 per month. Hilary Mbowell, another teacher and social critic, says private employers do not respect the minimum wage because the government does not police private companies.
Proprietors know that if they do not respect the minimum wage, nobody calls them to account. And so since there is nobody to call them to account, nobody to punish them, they do it with impunity.
The government says there has been a 10% pay raise since 2023, but workers say with inflation so high, the raise is negligible. The government says the inflation rate is about 8%. Cameroon's Minister of Labor and Social Security, Grégoire Ona, says the fragile world economy and several armed conflicts that the government has to manage make it impossible for the state and private investors to satisfy the needs of all workers.
Plus les problèmes se posent, plus on est en train de les résoudre, les acteurs.
Owana says limited financial resources make it difficult for the government of Cameroon to solve the myriad problems affecting workers. He says Cameroon President Paul Biya has ordered competent officials to make sure the wages of all government workers are paid regularly and as agreed in their employment contracts, while the possibility of improved workers' rights, decent working conditions and fair compensation are being examined. Moki Edwin Kinzaka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Economic and accountability bodies in Malawi urge the government to address flaws in the public procurement system. A 2021 Malawi Assurance report on public infrastructure projects suggests pervasive corruption in Malawi's public sector. The construction industry is particularly affected. Chimwemwe Padata has the story from Lilongwe.
Potholes and other road defects are an integral part of the daily urban experience. Beyond posing a threat to drivers and their passengers, they represent one of the impediments to the socio-economic development of a country.
The current condition of the road is increasing vehicle costs number time.
As a result of the deteriorating road condition, motorists take 3 hours travel between Lilongwe and Kasungu, a distance that was initially covered in less than 2 hours. Economist Beth Apiri is adamant that the country's road infrastructure has affected economic growth.
If we do have a good road infrastructure, what it entails is that the social and economic development can flourish so easily, because the roads have a potential actually to stimulate the volume of trade, opening up of new markets, attracting more investors actually.
Accountability and Transparency Board is pointing out flaws in public procurement systems that enable bribery, allowing unqualified construction firms to secure major contracts.
We have seen contracts being awarded to individuals who do not have even a single machinery, a single company. We have also seen infrastructure projects that are of substandard simply because there was collusion between government officials and contractors, and the result is delivery of poor infrastructure projects.
In response to growing concerns about the condition of the country's roads, Minister of Transport and Public Works Jacob Hara has reassured Malawians of swift rehabilitation efforts. Against this background, the construction industry regulator, the National Construction Industry Council of Malawi, NCIC, has upped its game, providing supervision on existing projects.
There are circumstances that lead to poor quality of infrastructure, one of which would be corruption. Some projects have actually failed at conception. The way the project is conceived, it is already a failure. Sometimes they fail at procurement.
The industry regulator has started issuing stop orders on construction projects that have breached contractual agreements in line with the National Construction Industry Act. Commuters say urgent actions are needed to fix the existing road network and ensure the implementation of the country's ambitions. Malawi envisions creating a multimodal transport system by year 2063. One of the key components of the plan is to have well-maintained and upgraded roads connecting urban and rural areas.
In the next few years, we'll pick up, especially looking at the large projects such as roads, which don't take months, even a year, to be completed. But we expect, because we have seen a lot of commitment from the government, we have seen a lot of commitment from the private sector, we have seen a lot of commitment from development partners.
A 2023 World Bank Transport Infrastructure Sector Assessment Program report shows that Malawi needs 1.5 trillion kwacha, an equivalent of $8.6 million for road projects by 2025 to spur economic growth. Chimwemwe Padata, VOA News, Lilongwe, Malawi.
A majority of younger voters in this U.S. presidential election say they wish they had someone other than Joe Biden or Donald Trump to choose from. Some of that has to do with the candidates' advanced ages. But who are the younger voters backing of the two? VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has the story.
In a race between the two oldest presumptive major party nominees to run for president, there are questions in this campaign about the candidates' fitness for office, especially from younger voters. Desmond Kager would like a different choice.
Republicans or Democrats can, put someone on the ticket that actually is, you know, worth voting for, then I'll vote for them.
A Pew Research survey last week found that two-thirds of voters under age 30 would replace both candidates if they had the chance. So who are the young people backing Biden or Trump? Concerns about reproductive rights means Biden has the support of Francesca Paniello.
I think abortion is important to me, abortion care, the right to be able to choose.
Abortion rights and recreational marijuana are both on the Florida ballot this November. That's bringing out younger voters for Democratic causes, says Jaden D'Onofrio.
Youth voters have a real opportunity to shape the electoral landscape here in Florida. We've seen that the right to choice and recreational marijuana are critical to the beliefs and importance of youth voters and what's top of mind for them, especially with the right to choice.
Some young people oppose Biden for his support for Israel in the war in Gaza, but that's likely to earn him the vote of Eliana Stein.
Right now, for me, one of the most important things is continued support for Israel, especially throughout this conflict that's going on. So I really appreciate everything that President Biden has been doing to support the country of Israel in this current conflict.
Young people supporting Trump include Wisconsin voters Brianna Bonilla and Jonathan Boyer.
I've tried to have conversations with people who don't like Trump, and they're like, you can leave. I don't want to talk to you more. So I think that's the main problem. People aren't open to listening. They're just like, if you like Trump, you're a horrible person, or just that. So I feel like...
Yeah, there's never any open discussion,
I feel
really.
Like if you're able to have an open discussion, I feel like a lot of people make it say, you know, they just come off like you can't say anything, or they won't talk to you, or they'll tell everyone. And
young Trump supporters are accustomed to people their age questioning their political choices, says Isaiah Turner.
I'll go to the bars wearing a Trump 2024 hat, and I get weird looks like crazy all around for people, but I don't really, it doesn't bother me.
Turner says he admires Trump's stance against corruption.
I think there is a ton of corruption. I think that there's a lot of very scandalous things that is going on all over the world. And I think Trump is one of the only men that has actually had the balls on him, so to say, to call out these people and not be afraid of them. I just feel like he's going to do what's best for the country, you know?
A Reuters Ipsos poll in March showed Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 favor Biden over Trump by 3 percentage points. That's a far smaller margin than the 24% gap that Biden won the youth vote with 4 years ago. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Britain has sent the first asylum seeker to Rwanda a week after adopting a controversial law allowing irregular migrants to be sent to the East African country. The person who went to Rwanda had lost his request for asylum in Britain and agreed to accept transportation to Kigali and a payment of about $3,700 under a voluntary departure plan. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's government has made the fight against illegal migration a priority as it hopes to recover ground on the main opposition Labour Party ahead of an expected general election late this year. The French news agency AFP says the announcement of the departure comes just 2 days before local elections in England and Wales, in which the ruling Conservatives are expected to suffer major losses to Labour. The controversial asylum law, which has come under fire from the United Nations and rights groups, allows Britain to expel undocumented migrants to Rwanda, where they would be allowed to remain if their asylum applications are successful. UN peacekeepers have ceased operations in the DRC's restive South Kivu province after more than 20 years. The French news agency AFP reports that MONUSCO's mission, which began to wind down in January, would now limit operations to northern Kivu and Ituri provinces. MONUSCO head Binutu Keita said responsibility for the security and physical protection of civilians now lies with the country's defense and security forces in close coordination with community and other local leaders. As part of its disengagement, MONUSCO said it has transferred 2 military bases to national authorities. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.